My guest today, Grant Smith, is one of the country's foremost investigative journalists. I said on his four previous appearances on this program, going back to 2006, one of his best kept secrets. That may be explained by the focus of his work, uncovering the hidden history of Israel's behind the scenes effort to control not only U.S. policy with regard to Israel, but the public dialogue as well, what I described earlier as a low-intensity war on the American people. That, it seems, is too hot a story for even the best of our alternative media. As director of research at the Washington-based Institute for Research Middle East Policy, or IRMAP, which he founded in 2002, Smith has produced six books, which include Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America, in 2006, which we spoke with him about at the time, Foreign Agents, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee from 1963, Fulbright Hearings to the Current Scandal in 2007, Declassified Deceptions, The Secret History of Isaiah Kennan and the Rise of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in 2007, America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's Battle to Register the Israel Lobby as Agents of a Foreign Government, which we spoke about in 2008, and Spy Trade, How Israel's Lobby Undermines America's Economy. He's also in charge of an extraordinary website, the Israel Lobby Archives, which you can find online at www.irmep.org/ILA. Today we're going to talk with him about his latest effort, Divert, Neumek, Zalman Shapiro, and the diversion of U.S. weapons-grade uranium into the Israeli nuclear program, which will be published next month. Welcome once again, Grant Smith, to Takes on the World.
Thank you so much, Jeff, and congratulations for a decade of radio programming focusing on this region and U.S. policy. It's just fantastic.
Well, so has your the work that you've been doing over the same period of time. You know, if it wasn't so serious, it would be funny. But for almost the past decade, we've had the politicians and pundits fretting and warning us about Iran's non-existent nuclear weapons, while any discussion, let alone mention of Israel's several hundred already existing nuclear weapons and nuclear-armed submarines now, is off the table. And you've spent considerable time investigating how Israel in the 50s and 60s was able to divert weapons-grade plutonium from a plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania, Neumek, owned by a well-connected supporter of Israel, into Israel's nuclear weapons program. And in your new book, you present the documents that prove it. And not only was this theft not unique, but as you show, it represented a continuation of an Israeli policy of breaking American law for Israel's benefit and getting away with it that went back to the late 40s. Run it down for us.
Sure. Well, the book starts covering the Haganah arms smuggling network that David Ben-Gurion was instrumental in starting as he traveled to the U.S. as the executive director of the Jewish Agency in the mid-40s. And he had the help and support of many prominent Americans, such as Rudolf Sonnenborn and Henry Morgenthau Jr. and others who were able to use parallel funding apparatus alongside legitimate charitable relief fundraising to set up a network of front companies that were able to purchase surplus World War II weaponry, including some items that are quite surprising, a baby flat-top aircraft carrier, Remington munitions-making equipment, for pennies on the dollar, and in some cases actually steal sophisticated automatic weapons such as 50-caliber machine guns by utilizing a network of contacts that would move scrapped material into place and then take the functioning arms. And so all of this was in violation of arms export controls and neutrality acts passed by Congress, but the effort was extremely successful, including stealing chaplains' lists of different databases of Americans divided by religious affiliation in order to recruit for Israel's War of Independence. And so the book starts by reviewing the players in the Haganah arms smuggling network, including Abraham Feinberg and Nahum Bernstein, who learned a lot of lessons during this time about how to set up front companies and then how to pressure the Justice Department and FBI to back off whenever they were discovered smuggling arms.
Well, Feinberg, people probably don't know the name, but it was a very important player in American history because he was the one who came to the rescue of Harry Truman in 1948 when Harry Truman didn't have enough money to do a what they call a whistle-stop tour on the trains and supposedly put an envelope in President Truman's pocket with anywhere from a couple hundred thousand dollars to $1 million. And that's a story even John Kennedy, President Kennedy, used to tell.
Yes.
And then Feinberg, of course, became a good friend of Lyndon Johnson. Perhaps you talk about that, too.
Yeah, Feinberg is a key player because not only was he so influential in over Harry Truman and LBJ, but David Ben-Gurion also designated him to be the nuclear weapons funding coordinator in North America. And so this book uncovers new information about Feinberg, including his only recently released FBI file, which allows us to track his movements, and also information about his dealings with the Atomic Energy Commission, his establishment of the Wiseman Institute, which was and is remains a front organization. It's only recently been found to have designed nuclear vehicle reentry vehicles and acquired supercomputing capabilities for that. So Abraham Feinberg is an extremely interesting and key player in this network. He is, of course, he's passed away, but his influence continues and the organizations that he helped create continue.
Well, going back, Feinberg was one of a handful of very important people whose names have disappeared from history, but were very instrumental, certainly as much as any soldiers fighting for Israel in 1948. They were soldiers fighting for Israel here in the United States, which was not actually unknown. These people were being observed and followed, and files were kept on them by the FBI. And you have, some of them have now been declassified, and you've been able to put some of these on the Israeli Lobby Archive and put them in your book.
Right.
And it's astonishing to read this today and know, realizing the importance of what you have found out, that it's unknown among the American public, and there's really no desire on the part of the media to publicize. This is like, it's like the Pentagon Papers. It's actually as important as the Pentagon Papers.
Well, I can tell you that the American public is very interested in this, and the Feinberg section of the archive is certainly one of the most visited. Oh. Abraham Feinberg is really key to the New Mex story because, what we have here is a man who was able to really transcend U.S. law. He was ordered to begin filing as a foreign agent after he was discovered publishing a propaganda newsletter, and he simply shut it down rather than face any sort of legal action. The Israeli ambassador to the U.S. used Feinberg, according to FBI wiretaps, to shut down the potential prosecution of over 80 of these smugglers that we've just mentioned. So his political influence was key, and the lessons he learned about how to subvert rule of law were absolutely essential in this brazen attempt to smuggle nuclear material. Now, the book, it really covers this event in a way that's never been done before. As you've probably seen flipping through it, we're talking about a span of 55 years, for the core part of the story, between 1956 and 2011. And although there have been probably 100 news reports about the diversion, which either get key facts wrong or look at a different and at points arbitrary aspects of the story, what we've done with this book is put in enough documents and testimony and eyewitness accounts and wiretaps so that people can have this information in one easy-to-peruse location and then make up their own minds about what happened. I think that what we have here isn't a single smoking gun, but a series of shell casings represented by, again, wiretaps, employee eyewitness accounts of the diversion taking place as Shapiro supervised the stuffing of highly enriched containers of uranium into equipment that was bound for Israel, and all sorts of other interesting tidbits so that people can really see the full diversion and all of its unique aspects unfurl.
Well, one of the interesting documents is a dossier on Zalman Shapiro, who was a brilliant scientist, a chemical science, engineer, as you mentioned, or scientist, as you mentioned.
Absolutely.
Who founded NUMEC, a dossier which seems to be addressed to Shapiro by the government, was originally classified secret, in which over 8 pages it documents his primary loyalty to the State of Israel and his contacts with his Israeli government agents. And actually, in 1968, he invited 4 key Israeli Israelis, including the spy master of Jonathan Pollard, and a number of key nuclear scientists, people involved with the Israeli nuclear program, to come to NUMEC in Apollo, Pennsylvania. And he wrote a letter to the Atomic Energy Commission, you point out, asking permission for them to come there. I mean, what were these scientists doing? And then you find out, when you look at the dossier of Shapiro, that's part of the appendix, amazing documents in there, reproduction, reproduced, so you could read them yourself and see the redactions, that this guy clearly was working for Israel against the interests of the United States. Although he may not have seen it that way, he was obviously putting Israel's interests before that of this country.
Well, his whole perspective, and I see it more as an ideological framework that's for public consumption. I doubt he actually believes it. But his framework was that advancing Israel was advancing the U.S., and he would tell anybody who wanted to listen to that theory of his with abandon. And it certainly raised concerns by the FBI and Justice Department that he had that attitude, because he was also seeking the very highest security clearances in the United States. But you're right. Zalman Shapiro invited top operatives who were covert operatives, Ephraim Begin and Raphael Eitan, who later handled Jonathan Pollard, into NUMEC in 1968, which coincidentally was one of the periods of highest highly enriched uranium-235 losses that the plant experienced.
Yeah, talk about the diversion.
Yeah, the diversion was taking place over a period of time. You have 2% of the plant's highly enriched material being lost, whereas other plants engaged in similar production were losing just a fraction of that amount to normal processing losses. In 1980-81, as the FBI's second investigation centered on diversion and also government cover-up was underway, an employee eyewitness testified to the FBI that he saw Zalman Shapiro and unknown others stuffing equipment with highly enriched uranium canisters, which was then rushed to the piers of New York and shipped to Israel. So there was a loss detected in mid-1965. The Atomic Energy Commission, which was the regulator at that time, with its dual role of promoting and also regulating the industry, became aware of it, and they maneuvered to get Shapiro out of the picture by encouraging Atlantic Richfield to buy NUMEC, the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, this Pennsylvania organization that was losing all the uranium, buy it and then restore it to normal industry levels. And so Atlantic Richfield bought it. Zalman Shapiro left after discussions with Israelis in government and the commercial embassy. They were cautioning him not to be too upset and that his position was very important to Israel at NUMEC. But then he got another offer to work on advanced boosted hydrogen bomb designs at a firm called Kawecki Borelko. And this sent the entire White House into a huge crisis mode, trying to get him to either find another job or not take on that new position because they were so concerned about his past activities and ongoing relationships with Israeli nuclear weapons operatives and also Israeli intelligence. And so the story of how the government was more afraid of Zalman Shapiro and his various organizations that he was affiliated with, such as the Zionist Organization of America, are just key to this story. And what you can see by reading these very detailed accounts from within the Atomic Energy Commission, from within the White House, was the total inability of the government to deal with Zalman Shapiro and their fear of having to take on the lobby in a very public way and be made out to be the bad guys for withholding aid or military aid, et cetera. So it's a fascinating look inside how the U.S. Governance is utterly corrupted by this sort of behavior.
You have also a long memo from Kissinger in the book in which it's a discussion is in Washington, which was a classified document at the time, how to deal with Israel's nuclear weaponry, which the U.S. opposed them having because the difficulty it would make for Israel to make peace
right.
with its neighbors. And you see very prophetic today. But there, throughout the documents, there is a sense that there's a fear that here the United States, the biggest superpower in the world, has to be very careful in how it deals with Israel because of its, sometimes it's stated, but implied domestic power.
Right. Well, that document is key because it really documents the policy of strategic ambiguity where the U.S. would simply pretend it didn't know anything about Israel's nuclear arsenal and that the worst thing wasn't, at this point, because it was unstoppable, the worst thing wasn't the arsenal. It would be the fact of the arsenal becoming public knowledge. And so this idea that if the U.S. doesn't acknowledge it, it's not there, or that it doesn't have to be discussed, is kind of this big lie or absence of discussion about nuclear weapons in the region that Americans continue to suffer from. But this was the genesis of that policy, and it certainly centered around the inability and the sort of lack of sovereignty of the U.S. government in this case, its lack of ability to control material technology, scientists who were pitching into the effort.
One other interesting aspect for an environmentalist is that this story of NUMEC is not over, that right now the government, because as you write about the treatment of the not only the workers under NUMEC, but the land, the environment around the plant by Shapiro is totally negligent at best, irresponsible, and today they're spending $170 million, Army Corps of Engineers, to clean it up. Perhaps you talk about that a bit.
Sure. Well, you know, what happened was that NUMEC, and you can see this in the FBI transcripts, didn't care at all about the environment. None of the key executives lived in Apollo, Pennsylvania, or Parks Township, where the majority of the activity was taking place. They were burying things in cardboard boxes or in improperly treated drums, which they acknowledged were out of compliance, illegally burying this stuff. And so part of the coup that they were able to achieve was that Atlantic Richfield took on all the liability for NUMEC's past action. And then a new firm took it over and was Babcock & Wilcox, was forced also to expend money on cleanup. Well, both of these corporations were receiving massive government contracts, so they kind of figured it was a cost of doing business to take off this inappropriately sited plant. The bottom line is that NUMEC should have never existed in the first place. When David Lowenthal acquired the plant, probably for nothing, it was either $500 purchase or zero, this defunct steel mill in the center of a village, it was a completely inappropriate place to have a nuclear reprocessing facility. And then they acquired a parcel of land just north of the property to dump all of their toxic waste, and even invited other firms to truck theirs in. And it was a site above a series, a warren of coal mine shafts that had been dug in the 1800s on a hilltop that was very susceptible and permeable to groundwater runoff. So we've got today this $170 million government, or let's say taxpayer-funded cleanup underway, and they're encountering problem after problem. In fact, they just ran into a major problem that they forced them to shut down the cleanup attempt. But, you know, one of the startling aspects of this story is just how the original founders of NUMEC, who were clearly in it to acquire the special nuclear material, have been able to externalize all of the costs of this plant, which never really had any value at all, except for its ability to tap the stream of highly enriched uranium.
You mean externalize, shift the cost onto the American taxpayers.
Exactly. American taxpayers, as you say, are on the hook for $170 million. I suspect it will be much, much more by the time it's totally cleaned up.
Well,
it never can be.
And, of course, with Israel's nuclear weapons program, we don't even know yet. We can't measure the cost that has been for American foreign policy.
What you mentioned at the beginning, the CIA's early estimate that the Israelis would be ever less willing to engage in bona fide peace negotiations once they acquired a nuclear weapon were part of the reason the Kennedy administration fought so hard to get inspections at Dimona and really shut it down, while simultaneously challenging Israel lobbying groups to begin registering as foreign agents. And so, you know, the outcome of this, that Israel would be as much aiming its nuclear arsenal at the United States in a form of nuclear blackmail, was well known to every single administration. And the fact that they weren't able to pursue a policy of averting that bad situation by challenging this and other maneuvers that Israel's engaged in is a complete failure of policy.
My guest is Grant Smith, and we're talking about his new book, Divert, NUMEC, Zalman Shapiro, and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Weapons Program. I should mention, in terms of back to Abe Feinberg and John Kent, President Kennedy, in Stephen Cy Hirsch's book, Samson Option, he mentions that Feinberg evidently was instrumental or believed instrumental in raising funds and getting Kennedy elected. And so after Kennedy gets into office, Feinberg visits him and tells him, we helped you get elected. Now we want to tell you what the Middle East policy is going to be. And Kennedy didn't explode until after Feinberg left the office, but he came out and told people what Feinberg had demanded of him. And this is kind of information which, you know, I talk about the Israel lobby all the time, a lot, because it's ignored, and it's an elephant that is on steroids, keeps growing and growing and growing, and controls our Congress and makes Washington, where you live, the most important occupied territory.
Well, Feinberg, you know, Kennedy was extremely leery of Feinberg, and among the first things he did upon taking office was ask for Feinberg's FBI file to see what the guy had been up to, you know, from his draft-dodging days. He's one of these kind of chicken hawks who, you know, in World War II, rather than go and fight, he dodged the draft and then had an attorney friend help unwind the district attorney interest in him. So he's a real case. But the Kennedy administration was afraid of him and was soon waging a battle to get the American Zionist Council, which was the apex of its day, properly registered, because it was bringing in overseas funding to lobby Congress and launch media campaigns. And so the Kennedys were really waging a two-front battle, one against Dimona and the other against the Israel lobbying organizations. And needless to say, they lost both battles.
Added to that, Kennedy was the last president to support Resolution 194, UN Resolution 194, which was the Palestinian right of return. Those are like three red lines that Israel could not allow to be crossed. You know, it's interesting that this book reads like a a thriller, a whodunit, and I mentioned to you in one of your emails, in an email, that this could be a movie. I mean, right. there are so many interesting characters and plots and turns.
Yes.
That it's an extraordinary read. And when you realize that we're talking about what was going on 40, 50 years ago affects our future today. It's interesting, going back, the FBI, the government, really looked with question at Shapiro and Neumeck. And in April 76, the Attorney General, that's under Carter, ordered the FBI to reopen the investigation of Shapiro and Neumeck. And it was that investigation was closed as soon as Carter was out of office, suddenly terminated.
Right.
Maybe you could talk a bit about that.
Sure. Well, actually, the Ford administration was very interested, and the Attorney General drew up an entire list of potential laws that might have been violated. And this is because CIA officials such as Carl Duckett and John Haddon began speaking candidly about what had happened, raising the interest of Congress in this case. And so the FBI began a two-track investigation. One was for Atomic Energy Act violations, the other was for cover-up. And they uncovered the fact that there had never been a proper investigation of the diversion aspects in 1965 when it would have mattered most. And here they have the statute of limitations running. But they interviewed regulators who said, yes, Shapiro was a serial fabricator. He wasn't telling us the truth. They interviewed Shapiro, or at least Congress did, and he was very evasive. The ground rules didn't permit any real questioning of the most basic questions, such as, what were all of these spies doing in your plant? Why did you invite them? And then finally, towards the end of the investigation, which, by the way, key people ducked, such as Glenn Seaborg, who is the head of the Atomic Energy Commission. He just outright refused to talk to the FBI because he probably wouldn't have been able to dodge the questions any longer. He was instrumental in presenting this idea that Neumeck was a processing loss case rather than a diversion case. But anyway, they finally come down to employee eyewitness accounts of the crime taking place. And the question arises, well, who in government really exacted a cover-up of all of this, and what can we do now? Are we really going to indict Zalman Shapiro under a death penalty level crime? Are we actually going to take that route in the final month of the Carter administration? And of course, the answer was no, and there's no indication that they ever even passed the file on to the Reagan administration. So the case whimpers and dies while, again, the environmental and strategic impact continues.
And Shapiro is still alive at 91 and claims it's all untrue. Time is 9:49, and I'm going to open the phones to the listeners, 895-2448. And we do have a persistent caller here. Hello, you're on the air.
Shalom, Jeffrey. I wondered if you're bragging or complaining. You have so many nice things to say, but the question for Mr. Smith is, which great seaport would we bring all our wheat into? What ships, where we ship it to all of Europe and the Middle East?
Speaking of
when
wheat,
they're starving, which seaport other than Haifa do you suggest we bring our goods into Europe?
That question seems to be off the subject. We're not talking about shipping goods to Europe. We're talking about the diversion of weapons-grade uranium to Israel in the 50s and 60s. One of the things that you see here is that, and we see it. Oh, here's a call coming. I'm going to give this person a chance here. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning, Jeff. I wondered if Grant Smith could comment on this issue that came up this morning where the president is suggesting he is going to restrict the export of oil and oil products to other nations from Iran, and the Iranian vice president is threatening to close the Straits of Hormuz to all oil shipments. How does Grant Smith feel that the president is going to put this restriction upon Iran?
Yeah, good question. I think Jeff mentioned it all as well, but the idea is secondary boycotts of pressuring Europe and other regions not to buy Iranian oil, which, of course, is an act of economic warfare. And so I think it's extremely ill-advised. But we could do an entirely different show on how the Treasury Department has been engaged in low-level economic warfare since the Bush administration, trying to cut off Iran and strangle it economically. So I think it's an extremely bad move. I think it's going to backfire. And he may goad the Iranians into firing the first shot by closing the Straits of Hormuz. And I don't think anybody expected that.
Well, it's actually, you mentioned the Treasury Department, beginning with the Bush administration, the people who have been responsible for counter-terrorist financing have been, in a sense, paid agents of the Israel lobby. Stuart Levy, they've spent time in Israel, gone to school in Israel, speak before AIPAC. It's like the Israeli government has taken over offices within the executive department. This began in the Bush administration during fomenting the war in Iraq with the Office of Special Plans set up by Douglas Feith, when the CIA wouldn't produce the kind of information about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. It's a dangerous situation, and yet we don't see, as I mentioned earlier before I called you, the public concern about the potential of a war with Iran and what it will do not only to our economy but to the world economy.
Yeah, it would be a tragedy.
And this is why what you've put in your book is so important, that people begin to discuss it and start asking questions. The questions like you asked and the information that you provided here is actually devastating, besides being fascinating.
Well, if Americans want to know how diversions take place between civilian programs and weapons programs, all they have to do is read this book, and they might begin to understand that this is far more important than anything Iran has been proven to be engaged in.
And Iran, of course, has not launched a war on anybody. The same kind of propaganda is being used. There are some interesting characters in your book. One of those guy, David Lowenthal, you mentioned.
Right.
Tell us who he is and why the government was interested in him.
Well, David Lowenthal came out of nowhere. He's a Polish immigrant and lived in modest accommodations in New York until he joined the effort to relocate displaced persons to Palestine in contravention of the British ban on that. And so he became a smuggler, and he had firsthand experience seeing how all the money laundering operations worked and the cash-only financing of the President Warburg, which became the Exodus. And this is the man who set up NUMEC through a financial merger of three companies with two other Zionists in order to launch this this nuclear reprocessing industry. He was tailed by the CIA. He was considered to be in ongoing high-level contacts with Israeli intelligence. The entire CIA portion, however, of the FBI file is completely blacked out, so we can't tell what he was doing as he traveled to Israel even more frequently than Shapiro, but he was always there during key decision points of the Israeli nuclear program, whether it was, you know, weapons designs or the funding mechanism or what have you. So David Lowenthal is a figure that we'll be hearing more about in the future, I assume, but a very key figure who came out of nowhere and was suddenly shuffling million-dollar businesses to launch NUMEC in 1956.
We referred to it earlier, but this the NUMEC was a continuation of a program to covert program is to support the state of Israel by every means necessary.
Right.
And you have a reference here to what they call the Sonnenburg smuggling network, which was initiated, actually, I guess, by a visit from David Ben-Gurion.
Right.
Maybe you could tell us about that.
Sure. At that time, Ben-Gurion was head of the Jewish Agency, which, by the way, the same building was also the site of the Weizmann Institute. So you have sort of this smuggling network, both nuclear and conventional, being run out of the same New York corporation, the Jewish Agency, which was a quasi-Israeli governmental organization after the state was founded. But the core business was always to obtain by any means necessary through supporters in the United States everything that Israel needed, whether it was manpower, money, arms, and in this case, nuclear material. So if you understand how the front companies function and continue to function, you can really examine NUMEC within this perspective. It had very little capital invested, whether a corrupt DOJ attorney or other members of the board, they were all dedicated to Israel's future. And it just bears all the hallmarks of a successful front company that could be ditched after its core purpose had been served. And you see that, the uranium loss takes over a 10-year period. It's detected. It becomes increasingly difficult. Shapiro bails out and tries to continue serving Israel by accessing advanced weapons design. So only by looking at how these front organizations function can you really see NUMEC for what it is. And that's why it took 300 pages to do.
300 pages, the name of the book, Divert! NUMEC, Zalman Shapiro, and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Weapons Program. Your website, airmep.org, is an amazing site, and I recommend all of you to go there. You could see the names of the books that Grant has written, and they're available on the site. Also, I mentioned the Israeli Lobby Archive. If you want to get the most deepest background of documents that have come out about the Israeli Lobby Archive, it's a very unique website. Grant Smith, I want to really thank you very much again for being our guest the fifth time on Takes on the World, and I look forward to the next time as well, and keep doing the great work you've been doing.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, Jeff. Thank you very much.